The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
We're picking up in the last section of our discussion on the medieval preparation summary for the Reformation. We're covering a lot of material because we don't have time to focus on it, but at least there are terms we want you to be exposed to and have a little bit of an idea about. In terms of the notion of the forerunner, we realize that the word forerunner, again, is an interpretive term. What are we looking at to determine whether someone is preparing for the Reformation? There are different emphases that different people had that in certain ways began to focus on the reformational theology. For example, in Italy, there was a man by the name of Savonarola who is often viewed as a forerunner. And basically, his purpose was to purify the church because of its opulence and luxury. He was ultimately burned at the stake. And Savonarola is therefore viewed as a forerunner because one of the great cries of the Reformation was the abuse of the wealth of the church. And so that would be one example. We've already mentioned Wycliffe. Wycliffe was clearly a forerunner of the Reformation because of his emphasis on biblical translation so that it might be in the language of the people. He did his translating from the Latin Vulgate into English. And also he had a very clear understanding of authority, and his views of authority challenged the primacy of the papacy. So to the extent that the papal authority was being undermined or challenged by Wycliffe, you could see he as a forerunner in that sense. Huss, who was from Bohemia, modern-day Czechoslovakia, in that area of Eastern Europe, was a follower of some of Wycliffe's writings, and he is especially known for his emphasis on communion in both kinds. He's one of the first pre-reformers who said the Lord gave bread and wine to his people, and it's wrong to provide only the bread. And so that was an element of his teaching. And ultimately, he was burned at the stake for following Wycliffe and emphasizing his views. His movement was called the Ultraquist movement. Okay. Another key movement, and a very fascinating one, was a group of people from the medieval period who followed a gentleman by the name of Peter Waldo. They become known as the Waldensians. Waldensians were a quasi-evangelical church that existed in the Alps. They had a French-Italian connection, and they actually became part of the French Reformed movement after they were exposed to Calvinism. They were ruled somewhat by elders, and they had a biblical sort of focus and understood something about the primacy of Scripture. So they were, in a sense, a forerunner of reformational thinking. Another important, obviously, reformational movement would be the focus on biblical studies. And there are some really important names that we should be aware of in this, and that one would be a fellow by the name of John Collett, C-O-L-E-T, who was for a while in Italy and ended up also in England. And he was one of those early men who began to challenge the classic medieval fourfold exegesis of a text. You know, there's the literary model, and then you have to also the anagogical, the allegorical, and other insights that raise you to a higher understanding of Scripture. He was one of the early ones that began to develop the historical, grammatical, exegetical, contextual sort of exegesis that has been a prime characteristic of the Protestant movement. We have a French reformer by the name of Jean Lefebvre d'Etaples. Lefebvre is how he's often known. He was actually in Paris, and he is a clear forerunner of the Reformation that has a link with Calvin. I think mediated by one generation between of students from Lefebvre to Calvin. There's a direct implication. And Lefebvre, very interestingly, about the time that Luther was beginning to be well known for his reformational insights, Lefebvre had already published books on commentaries on Paul that were very clear on justification by faith. So there was a very strong emphasis already in certain circles among the humanist scholars on a return to a biblical understanding. But they made no impact because they did not have the spark that Luther brought to the explosion. Okay, so the time and the place are important. So we ought not to think that Luther is the first to understand the gospel in its real reformational sense. There are those who before him got there, and Lefebvre would be an example. We've already mentioned Erasmus, the great reformer who always stayed within the church. Erasmus was very critical of the Roman Catholic Church. And actually, he seemed to be very much in favor of Luther's Reformation until Luther wrote his book, The Bondage of the Will, in 1525. That book was aimed directly at Erasmus, and that split the movement between Luther and the humanists. The older humanists will reject Luther. The younger humanists will follow him. That's another fascinating sociological study. The humanists, the scholars of the day that are younger, are going to become Lutherans. The older ones are going to stay and follow Erasmus and stay in the church. But Erasmus said, we've got to get back, not to the Vulgate, but to the Greek. And we've got to reform the church. His reformational model was not a theological reformation, but it was an educational reformation. We need to re-educate the priests. We need to get them back to primary sources. We need to teach the truths of the Bible from this model, all within the church's life. And so to that extent, he is clearly a forerunner, but he will not follow through. So under the category of forerunners, there are a whole host of individuals that would fit there, and I've given you an example of a few. Another theological movement that anticipates and prepares for the Reformation is what we could call mysticism. Now, why would mysticism prepare for the Reformation? Because many of you would think, well, mysticism sounds like it would maybe fit more with Pentecostalism than historic reformational biblical Christianity. Well, the reason that it's often seen as a forerunner is because the church had begun through the centuries to emphasize its uniqueness as the sphere of salvation. There is no salvation outside the church. There is a true church. And if you're going to be saved, you must be in the church, receiving its sacramental administrations, and thereby receiving the saving grace that it alone can impart. Now, what does mysticism say? You don't need a mediator. You can go directly to God. You don't have to go to the cathedral. You don't have to go to the priest. You just open yourself up, and you have a personal experience from within, you see? And so the emphasis on an immediate relationship with God in a spiritual way is a challenge to the institutionalization of the sacraments in the Catholic tradition. And to the extent that that had begun to take root, there was a seedbed for a new way of approaching God through the gospel, which would be taught then through the Protestant movement. Now, this movement of mysticism actually, in a certain way, anticipates some of what Protestant modern liberalism has taught. You may have studied Schleiermacher through the years, and his view is that there's a certain sense where we all have a spark or passion of divinity in each heart, and that what we do is we just go within and we find God on the inside. In a post-Kantian world, you can't find God. You can't trust the Bible. So you don't go outside, you go inside. And that's really the essence of Protestant liberalism. Well, these medieval mysticists said much the same thing. They argued that there was something called a synteresis. That's the Latin word. A gemüte is the German word. There was a spark of the divine within, and you go inside. At this point, the idea was you don't have to go outside to the priest. You don't have to go into a convent or a monastery. You just begin to look for God inside. You can see that individualization perhaps prepared the way for a movement that emphasizes your personal faith, your personal relationship with Christ and justification. Another example of this is the Devotio Moderna, coupled with a movement called the Brethren of the Common Life, again, having a Dutch context in many cases. What was unique about this movement is that they had begun to say, we need to have portions of the Bible translated into the language of the people so that they can read them on their own. And so the modern devotion, as opposed to the Devotio Antigua, the old devotion of going to the church to get the sacramental grace, was to stay at home and read the Bible and find a spiritual renewal through this. And again, you can see that that has a direct preparation for the Reformation with its emphasis on the primacy of Scripture. So when we finally come with all of these forces, if you will, kind of like an inverted pyramid, all of this weight with a point weighing on Luther, there's a lot of energy behind this man. And his theology is going to somehow be impacted by all of these forces. And there was a fissure, if you will, a breakage in the Corpus Christianorum that will be exploited by Luther's teaching. It will explode, and it will actually cleave Europe into two bodies that will never be able to heal after that point. So there's a certain sense in which the right man was at the right time. Okay? Now, we're not going to talk about Luther today. We're going to talk about Luther next class. So since we're kind of painting the big picture, let's go past Luther now, and very quickly let me say just a few things about these three streams that unfold: the Magisterial Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, and the Radical Reformation. Okay, we're getting, remember, the big bird's eye view. We'll come back to all these things in different ways in a lot more depth as we go through. The Magisterial Reformation will divide into three major movements. We can speak of them as the Lutheran, Reformed, and Elizabethan. Obviously, the Lutheran movement is the church that will stem directly from Luther's teaching, largely in the Germanic and Scandinavian lands. It will find rootage elsewhere. But by and large, outside of those lands, Lutheranism will be swallowed up by later movements, so either the Reformed or the Elizabethan. The Reformed movement will have two basic divisions, following the German-speaking Zwingli or the more French-speaking lands under the Calvinist tradition. And then by Elizabethan, we mean the English under Elizabeth, who we'll tell that story later, who actually will develop what's called a via media, a middle way where she tries to bring Protestant theology together with Roman Catholic liturgy. And we get the Episcopal Church in America from that. The Anglican Church is really a synthetic church, and that was consciously designed as a compromise in a time of religious upheaval. And it's been called the Elizabethan movement because Good Queen Bess was ruling during that time. And from that synthesis, there have been many divisions that have emerged. Okay, so if we go back and look at the next splits, let's go back to the top of Lutheran. There are two movements that will develop from the Lutheran movement. There's the Genesio Lutheran movement. These are those that would insist on the absolute primacy of Luther's insights. And the best reflection of that today would be the Missouri Lutheran Synod in America, very keenly committed to Luther's high theology, not so worried about the practical piety of life, but of the pure theology of Luther. Now, stemming from that early time, there's a movement called the Philippist movement, and that's named for Philip Melanchthon. Melanchthon, we will learn, is the right-hand associate of Luther. Philip was willing to be much more accommodating of different theological streams. And out of Melanchthonian influences, we will have Lutheran Pietism that will develop. Lutheran Pietism is actually what brought the Mount Airy Seminary not far from here to America. That movement, the early missionary movement in Lutheranism, were basically Philippists. They were Pietists. They had the emphasis, while theology is really important, what's more important is your personal relationship with God. And so have you ever heard of small groups? Do you know who invented those? Lutheran Pietists. Okay, this is part of their movement. Have you ever heard of such things as, all the things that made Methodism important in America. Charles Wesley just got that from the Pietists in Europe and brought them to England. And so they really started that practical discipleship type of model that's a big part of even American evangelicalism today. That has its rootage in Lutheran Pietism. Over against that, you have the more doctrinal, theological, confessional model of the Genesio Lutherans, which, would, as I mentioned, have their continued expression. In the Reformed heritage, we have best examples of the conflict between Zwingli and Calvinistic over the different views of the Lord's Supper in the Reformed tradition. Zwingli, who seemed to be much more comfortable with the idea of a memorial presence, whereas Calvin argued for a spiritual, real presence of Christ in the Supper. Again, we'll look at that debate later. But especially in the Elizabethan context, we might expect to be a fair amount of division because it was a politically enforced theological solution. And as a result of the Anglican Middle Way, we have some that begin to emphasize the liturgy of the church, and that becomes the high church. We have others in the Anglican tradition that emphasize the theology and say, forget about so much of the liturgy. That's the low church, but maybe more confessionally and theologically oriented. Out of this, and for those of you that are in the Presbyterian heritage and you're at Westminster Seminary, you need to remember that the Westminster Assembly was made up of Anglicans. That's what they were. They were members of the English Church. But they wanted to reform the church. They didn't like the solution of having a bishop and some of the worship of the Catholic liturgy. And so they were trying to figure out a way to reform the church completely. And so the Presbyterians were initially Anglicans, and they wanted a Presbyterian government with various types of changes of Puritan emphases on life and conduct. It's significant that when the Westminster Assembly first met, their goal was simply to perfect the 39 Articles of the Anglican Church. They weren't even going to write a new confession. They finally set it aside and came up with the Westminster Confession. But they intended to keep the Anglican theology in place. So the Reformed Presbyterian tradition really is very much flowing out of the Anglican heritage. The Congregationalists were also present at Westminster. They happened to believe in this Calvinistic theology, but they didn't believe in the government of either bishops or elders in a Presbyterian-type setting. They thought there should be independent local communities governed by elders with a great deal of influence to the congregation. And then finally, you had some that had given up altogether on all the church models and said, we're just going to be our own seekers. And those were the independents, those who said, we have nothing to do with anybody but ourselves, and each church has to make its own way in the world. And those obviously are going to give different expressions. Out of that movement, the Anglican high and low church, we're going to get the Episcopalian and Methodist movement. Out of the Presbyterian congregational independent, we'll get all of those churches, but ultimately also the independent movement will give birth to the modern day Baptist as they connect with some influences from the lower radical Reformation, which would be the Amish Mennonite believers' baptism ideas. Okay, now what do we see in the Counter-Reformation? Just a few quick ideas. Modern Catholicism as we know it, before Vatican II, was born by the Reformation. It came about as a result of the Council of Trent. And one of the ironies is that Luther was calling for a council. Remember we mentioned that quickly? He was condemned as a heretic for calling for a future council. Well, finally, the Roman Catholic Church said, all right, if you want a council, we're going to give you one. See, it's very clever. They turned the table on him, but they made sure that no Protestants could be in attendance. Okay? See, it's wonderful when you hold all the cards and you're playing the game, you know? So they said, okay, Luther, we vandalize it all, and we anathematize you. And as a result, the modern Roman Catholic theology was born that repudiated justification by faith, then all the distinctions. It's really Vatican II that began to change from looking at the Protestants as evil, lost, hellish people to being errant brethren, and maybe even now common participants in grace. It's fascinating as we see the unfolding of history here. Okay, but some of the accomplishments were the birth of the Jesuits, absolute obedience to the Pope, shock troops of the papacy, going out evangelizing the world, doing whatever the Pope says because he is Christ's vicar on earth. The Council of Trent, we just mentioned that quickly, they developed a great censorship standard, the Index of Forbidden Books. The Reformation emphasized the value of printing, and Luther's books were printed. We'll talk about that with the 95 Theses in particular. Well, there were a list of books forbidden that were to be burned. The Inquisition continues, and sadly, from my viewpoint as a Protestant, half of Europe was taken back by the Counter-Reformation. Eastern Europe had almost become entirely Protestant. It was the Counter-Reformation that took it back. Hungary, Poland, and these areas there had begun to turn very strongly in the Protestant direction. It was the Counter-Reformation that turned the tide and reclaimed those nations for the Catholic fold. Well, basically then, the Counter-Reformation develops at that time the historic Catholicism. Just an interesting point in passing. Did you know that the Catholic Church never had a canon until the Reformation? The canon question had always been left open. There were the deuterocanonical books, the classic traditional books of the Church. It was because the Protestants declared a canon that the Roman Catholic Church said there is a canon, and they added the apocryphal books to their canon and condemned the Church. Up to that point, they were really deuterocanonical, and it was the Council of Trent that gave the classic Augustinian canon, which included the Apocrypha, its official standing. And lastly, as we look at the Radical Reformation, I think we need to recognize that one of the great accomplishments of Reformation studies in the 20th century is rediscovering these bodies that have been largely ignored, because the Radical Reformation in their various expressions were persecuted by the Reformation and Counter-Reformation alike. So let me give you an example. I think it was about 1648 or thereabouts when the Westminster Assembly completed its work. 1648 was the year that the final peace was given at Westphalia. Westphalia is where Protestant, Calvinist, and Lutheran were all given permission to be openly practicing their religion and putting their churches on city streets, you know, downtown. You want a Protestant, Reformed, Lutheran, and Catholic church, they all be side by side, all legal. That was done in Europe. But if you went to any one of those areas as a radical reformer, as an Anabaptist, you could still be imprisoned. And I have, for example, in my church right now where I'm pastoring, I have a family who has a descendant in their history who was persecuted by the Reformed after Westphalia. He was put in a box, locked up, and his job was to make buttons. He was never let out of the box. He was fed there. He lived his whole life there. His legs began to grow crooked and all the other things that can happen. You know what his crime was? He believed in believers' baptism. This is not Roman Catholic persecution. This is Reformed Lutheran persecution. They had been given liberty, but they were not ready to give liberty to anybody else. I wonder if there are any Baptists that dare identify. Believer baptism hands? Okay, you'd have been put in the box. Isn't that nice? Okay, by people like me. That's scary. The reason I want to emphasize some of these things is not because I don't love the Reformation. I do. We need to tell the whole story to appreciate what we have in America. You know, not everybody likes American Presbyterianism, American Christianity. And as you go through church history, there's a tendency to want to go back to some of these early eras and say, man, they really had it right. In some ways, they did. In some ways, they didn't. And what we have today has some great blessings. So let's remember as we look at these things that we don't pretend they were somehow halcyon days, that they were somehow perfect. No, they had their blessings, but they had their problems too. A danger of theology, and for seminarians in particular, is what we can call repristination, where you want to go back to the primary experience and relive it all over again. No, you can't do that. I've spent a lot of my life studying the Reformation, and I finally realized the Reformation I have to be concerned about is the one that's right now. I need to learn from them and apply it here. I can't go back and try to be them. It won't work. There are unique circumstances that made it happen. But I have to learn from them and try to figure out how do I apply them in my ministry today. Okay, that's the issue. What do we learn from them so that we can live, not so that we can be just like them? That's a mistake. I'm really glad that no Baptist is being locked up by Presbyterians today. That's a tragic thing. It's happened in history, and it's sad. Now, I want to make it clear. There were also times when the Anabaptists conquered a city, and they put up their warfare and fighting. And it was the Mennonite movement that reacted to their own brethren and said, we'll be pacifists forever thereafter. So every movement has had their problems, as I've noted, with coercive power. But at any rate, as I was saying, the Radical Reformation has been rediscovered because in this era of American pluralism, whether we like it or not, that's where we live, has been able to look at some of these buried bodies. And a lot of research has been done in this lower level. We need to appreciate some of the great blessings that we have in America come from the Radical Reformation, even as many of the great theological blessings we share come from the Magisterial Reformation. Okay? And we'll talk about some of those implications as we go along. But let's identify three specific strains of the Radical Reformation. First of all, there's the Anabaptist. That really means the rebaptizers. That was not a name they took for themselves. They believed they were baptizing believers properly for the first time. They'd never been baptized. The water given in infancy, they rejected. So they saw themselves as brethren, for example. And the brethren followed, especially from Zwingli in one case, the Swiss brethren. And we have another movement called the Spiritualists. The Spiritualists were those like a man named Kaspar Schwenkfeld. Okay, there have been Schwenkfelders here in Pennsylvania. Maybe you've heard that movement named in the various areas. He developed what was called a Stillstand, a moratorium on the sacraments. He said, all we do is fight all the time about how do you baptize, how do you administer the Lord's Supper. He said, let's just stop doing it altogether and wait for further revelation to do it right. In the meantime, let's partake of baptism by the Spirit in our hearts. Let us commune with Christ inwardly, feeding upon the hidden manna of God by faith. And so they were sacramental. Less. No sacraments. They were inward, spiritually led. Well, out of that movement will come groups like the Quakers, for example, which are very important here in Philadelphia. The utter rejection of the outward forms of preaching and ordination and having no sacraments, but having an inner life of the Spirit. The Anabaptists will produce a group like the Mennonites and the Amish. Okay, and we've heard of them and seen them, and they still exist in Pennsylvania and other areas. And finally, the rationalist movement, the growing from the Radical Reformation, are those that emphasize, as we've noted earlier, the rationality of theology, and if something doesn't make sense, you're not required to believe it. And so the Trinity is rejected by some, such as the Italian rationalists, the anti-Trinitarians. Another movement that will come out of Poland is following a man named Faustus Socinus. The Socinians will be part of the Radical Reformation, and one of their emphases will be if it doesn't make sense, we reject it. They could not believe in the penal substitutionary view of the atonement, that Christ would die in the place of sinners to satisfy God's wrath. They reject Anselm's and Calvin's expression of substitution. In its place, it's the exemplary theory. And so in a certain way, we have this view of the atonement of Socinus that's representing where much of the modern theology will go. Modern liberalism will move in the direction of this rationalist stream. And so it's very interesting. The great scholar of the Radical Reformation in the 20th century is a man named George Williams, who taught at Harvard for several years. And in his, really, it's a classic work in the field called The Radical Reformation. He says, it is rather ironic, isn't it, that I am a theologian teaching at Harvard, a school that's fully committed now to Unitarian rationalist thought that was founded by Reformed theologians. He said, our movement that was persecuted by them has won out. Now think about that. That's true. The radical reformations, Unitarian, Universalist, and those sorts of ideas have overcome most of the religious schools in America that were started by the Reformed tradition. So that's a fascinating observation. You can weep about it, laugh about it, but it's a fact. Okay? So there's your survey of the big picture. Okay? Now, am I going to test you on this like this? No. My goal is to give you a map. I hope you'll sit back and kind of try to make yourself think through it, get used to the vocabulary and the ideas, so that, because we'll refer to this kind of a grid as we go forward. Very quickly on the next page, let me just turn over. I won't take you through this next chart. This is far too complicated to do, and this is a whole course here. But what I do want you to see as you look at the next chart, it's called the Confessional History of the Reformation. Remember, as I said, I think back in our first hour today, that this was an era of confessions. Each movement determined that it would declare what it believed by writing it down. And the reason for that is because the confession was an act of state as well as act of church. And so that we actually can find examples of creeds being written in such a way to solve political problems in the Reformation. So it's theology and politics going on. And so what we see here are the interplay of all sorts of theological ideas. Keep this page handy, because throughout the course, periodically, we're going to talk about these different confessional positions that will be developed. And you can see at the bottom that each stream will ultimately create its own confessional heritage. There's a Roman Catholic confession, the Council of Trent. The Anglican tradition, represented now best by the 39 Articles. The Lutheran tradition has the formula of Concord. If you are in the more Gnesio-Lutheran movement, if you've gone back to the earlier movement, like many have in the Pietist tradition, they just emphasize the Augsburg Confession, which starts it all off, and we'll talk about that along the way. There's the Presbyterian tradition, and then ultimately the Reformed. The Baptist tradition, if you say, where are they? They would actually grow out of the Presbyterian tradition, and they do have, for example, their Confession of Philadelphia. And that is very much like the Westminster Confession, except on the sacrament of baptism. They would change some of that, couple issues of church and state. But by and large, it's very Reformed. So that chart I won't work through today, but I give it to you for reflection. And the other pages, I think, are self-explanatory, and I won't say any more about that at this point. Before I pass out my last page that I want you to look at, are there any questions or comments on our introductory Mad Dash survey of Reformation City? Okay. If not, let me give you this last page. This is one page exactly the same. Let's just pass that out, okay? I want to conclude this study by more formalizing some of the things we've already said about the interpretive schools of the Reformation. I've hinted at that several times, how a Catholic looks at the Reformation, how a secularist might look at the Reformation. The page that I'm giving you now outlines some of the examples of interpretations of the Reformation. And we'll conclude our time just looking at Roman numeral 1, letter A, and its subpoints. Okay? And I'll kind of give you some of my presuppositions on how I'm looking at the Reformation. So we take a look at how you interpret anything. We know that hermeneutics, or interpretation, is a fundamental reality of everything that you do. For example, the evening news, when it shows you what happens, is giving you a selection of what occurred that someone wanted you to see. Now, did they do a fair job in representing what you see or not? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I know of cases where there have been examples on the evening news where they show protesters and only six people showed up. But they focused on those, they chose as a news media to say those six people were worthy of being given a minute of news in the public eye. Now, was that because it was the popular view? No, someone was wanting to tell us something. Okay? So the idea of how we select what we interpret is a foundational bias and presupposition of all historical analysis. You know, you begin to ask the question of what is science? How do you do science? Well, you need to be observe it. You need to be able to measure it. You need to be able to repeat it. You need to be able to predict upon it. Can you do any of those things with history? Stop and think of, can you repeat history? Can you observe history? Not unless you're an eyewitness. And can you test history? Can you predict from history? Not if you don't have a prophetic gift, you're not really sure what's going to come next. In other words, history is not science. It is an art form. And in an art form, You are using knowledge, but you're doing it profoundly with your personal biases always at work. In fact, the very fact that you're required to take a course on the Protestant Reformation is a bias. You know, we could say here at Westminster, forget that era. We're going to go and talk about the Aborigines in Tasmania and learn everything we could about them. And, you know, in a postmodern world, that is what is happening. They're saying, why have a European centricity? What makes it so important? Okay. You choose your values. Well, we've chosen a value, and we've said the Reformation is important. Okay. So let's be honest. This is a bias. History always brings with it interpretive values. What we select, what we leave out. Now, one of the things I want you to note, I've told you some of the dirty linen of the Reformation. Have you been listening? I have. Why? Because I'm trying to be authentic. I'm still not telling you all the bad news. And I'll let you learn some of that on your own. Because I'm going to emphasize so much the good news, I want you to know I'm not just pretending that there's not some bad stuff. There is. Okay, so we need to recognize our biases are always at work. Mine are, and so are yours. And as we go through this then, we need to realize that the teacher and the student both have sieves with which we begin to screen out material and evaluate and weigh it. Here are the classic sieves that are used by interpreters of the Reformation. Okay? There's the Protestant, the Roman Catholic, the secular, and what we could call the combinationalist. Now, what we mean by each is that they all assume a certain worldview value, and they operate on the basis of that. So if you're going to teach the Reformation with a Protestant interpretation, probably one of the things you're going to sit back and say is, you know, it's a really a good thing that Luther came on the scene. But he actually was good. And maybe if you're really a strong Protestant interpreter, you might actually say what Calvin says in the Institutes, that he is an apostle of Christ. Now think about that. That's quite a mouthful. Now, I'm sure he's using the word apostle with a small a and not a capital A. But still, Calvin was willing to look at Luther as an incredible representative of the gospel of the Holy Spirit and Christ in history. So that's one model. And as you begin to look at this emphasis under the Reformed tradition, you have a man like D'Aubigny, a classic Protestant interpreter from France, written one of the great studies of the Reformation. You know what he says? It's God's action in history. The Reformation is when God is broken into history and he's revealed himself with such dynamic grace that it's never been like it at any time before in history since the Apostolic Age. Now, that's pretty amazing. Okay, is that true? Maybe it is. But he is ready to say that what happened in the Reformation was a revival of the magnitude of what happened at Pentecost itself. Powerful position. Now, a milder Protestant view from the Reformed tradition was a man that I mentioned here by the name of Leonhard. This gentleman says, no, really what the Reformed Protestant movement is, it's really the full flowering of the Catholic faith. What he's trying to argue is that what Calvin and the others did was just bring out the best of what always was in the Catholic tradition and just let it shine in its purity. That there's no revolt, there's no break, it's not like some great revival happened, although there's a renewal. Rather, what it is, it's that the best of the Catholic tradition is now alive and well, and its mistakes and its confusions are removed. That's an interpretation. Do you see the difference? One is that it's always been there, and now we just clean it up. The other is that it was, man, we haven't seen it, and the Holy Spirit's brought it all about. So how do you weigh the facts, depending on which interpretation you hold? Now, from the Lutheran tradition, the Lutherans are very biased toward Luther, as you might expect. And by and large, they're very much in love with the Germanic setting of the Reformation. When you read German Lutheran scholars, you almost get the idea that the Reformation never happened anyplace else but in Germany. And that's a value judgment. Okay? So is it Germanic or is it broader? And the radical reformers have tried to tell us, you know, you Reformed and Lutheran-type interpreters, don't forget there are other people that were standing against the church trying to correct it too. You just didn't like their views. But you better pay attention to them because they've impacted the modern world in a huge way too. Okay? So these are some of the simple examples. Now, how does the Roman Catholic interpreter come at the Reformation? Well, the earliest interpretation of the Reformation and attempting to explain it in its classic form is by a gentleman named Spalding, and he wrote consciously against D'Aubigny. And his viewpoint is that the Reformation was a rebellion against the true church by the devil's influence. Well, D'Aubigny is going to talk about things such as the restoration of the family and universal education and bringing about all sorts of business renewal by getting rid of the monastic confusions. Whereas you're going to have a man like Spalding quoting Luther saying, my goodness, the Germans were better off than before the Reformation came. They don't seem to understand what we're teaching them. They're using the freedom from the Roman Catholic tradition to live in licentious rebellion and sin. You know, Luther said some things like that. So those are quoted and say, look, from his own mouth. That's confusions, mistakes. And one of the greatest arguments that the Roman Catholic Church has always used, and it has been very powerful for many in the modern world, is look at the Reformation has continued to cause splintering. How many Protestant groups can you outnumber today in the world? 10,000 maybe? None of them agreeing with each other? Well, how many Roman Catholic churches are there? So which is true? The one true Holy Catholic Church or the 10,000 churches that don't agree with each other? Who's on Satan's side and who's on God's side? Now, how do you deal with that? You're going to have to deal with that. That's a classic Roman Catholic apologetic against the Protestant movement. There is an answer. I hope you know it. If you don't, you have to find it because I'm not going to tell it to you. Maybe you'll learn it as we go along. But the point is, that's an interpretation. Do you look at the mistakes? Is it satanic? Is it a ruin? Is it a deceit? Well, as these things begin to unfold, obviously, as there's been a movement toward the ecumenical spirit in Catholicism, there's been a reappraisal of the Reformation. They've had to admit that maybe everything wasn't as rosy as they'd like to think in the earlier years. And so we have example of a man by the name of Grisar, who says really what it was is just the first major explosion of the problems between church and state in the West. There have been tensions, but this is really a political, ecclesiastical issue. That was one approach. Williamson, in talking about the English Reformation, argues greed. Henry VIII just wanted the church's lands, and so did the nobility. Tavard comes very close to what Leonard said in the Reformed tradition, that really there's an awful lot in common, and it was simply the need to correct things. And probably the most significant development has been this last view of a man named Janelle, J-A-N-E-L-L-E, who says it really the problem was in the church. The late medieval church had a huge problem, and it was anarchy. They had lost their cohesive spirit, and the Reformation was simply pointing out the fact that there was no clear leadership in the church. And so there's an admission of some problems. Another model that I don't list here, and I think I have time to highlight it, about the relationship of the late medieval period to the Reformation, is that there are those who would argue that really it was the nominalism of the age that was the problem theologically. That what was going on is that there had been a loss of this strong, logical, rational theology of St. Thomas. Remember, St. Thomas is the patron saint now of Roman Catholic theology. St. Thomas has been canonized as a theologian of the church. And so in this model, they would say, we have to admit we had a huge problem. We got away from the scholastic, clear theological model of the church, and we got into this nominalism with its skepticism. And as a result, there's not a surprise that we had chaos. And it took the Reformation to bring us to the Counter-Reformation, reestablishing the church's clarity. So that's kind of the ecumenical spirit. We had a problem, but it has been corrected, okay? And that is with authentic Catholicism. Now, on the other hand, there's a great Protestant scholar writing today by the name of Heiko Obermann, and if you've done any work in late medieval studies, you would certainly know his name. Instead of seeing this as a time of decay in theology, his classic book is called The Harvest of Medieval Theology. He argues that this is really the high watermark of medieval thinking. It was brilliant. You may not agree with it, but it was medieval theology at its very best. So you can see there's, again, the interpretive model at work. A Protestant saying there were problems in the church, but it wasn't theology. The theology was literally brilliant and well-conceived and well-developed. Okay, now you look at the Protestant Roman Catholic debate. We all kind of are going to have to deal with those, but what do you do if you come at it as a secularist? Okay, say, I got to study the 16th century, but I don't know that I believe there's even a God out there. How do you view this era? It's not about theology. And so you have different examples. You have a man by the name of Smith who writes a classic work that focuses on it's just really the development of science and ethics in the emergence of Western thought. You have a fellow by the name of Priester representing, if you will, the communist model. And he says it's all about socioeconomic issues, and we've hinted at that. Who has the gold? Germany was giving away the gold to Italy. So Italy that wanted the money stayed Catholic. Germany that didn't want to give it anymore had the Reformation. Van Gilder, it's the Renaissance that was the true Reformation. In other words, the Reformation is just a blip on the Renaissance screen. They happen to be some who got really into biblical studies, but that's not what it's all about. It's really the Reformation is just one expression of a whole new movement returning to the classic era. And in that model, then, the Reformation would be seen simply as an expression of humanist scholarship, not that it's theologically a model for us. And you have an example of a man named Dunn who would say, the whole problem with this is that There was no objective reflection. Everybody always comes at it with bias, that we need to have an authentic study of the era. Well, that kind of thinking brings us to, for example, the work of a man like Roland Bainton, who for many years taught at Yale, one of the classic Reformation scholars, and has written one of the great studies on Luther's life. In fact, his style of history is by writing biographies. He was a great biographer. But his position is this, that somehow every one of these systems captures some element of truth, and that we must recognize that there is an element in all of them. He was the son, I believe, of a Congregationalist minister, but he eventually became a Quaker himself, a pacifist. And so he had a lot of interest in the Radical Reformation, and did a lot to try to rehabilitate some of those individuals. But I think as I come at the class, I want to emphasize the breadth of all of these things. And as I conclude, my simple presupposition is this. As a Reformed Christian, I believe in providence. I believe that God is sovereign over everything, and that somehow Luther was on the scene of history because God wanted him there, and God was working through him. I'm willing to say that. But as I say that, I also recognize, for example, as the Westminster Confession says, that God's providence is mediated not only by the primary cause of God's sovereignty, but through the secondary causes of history. And that the problem with Daubigny's model, for example, is to always talk about God's work, which is true. But we must talk about the secondary causes that God has chosen to work with as well. So that we have to say, yes, there are economic concerns that are at work. And that a legitimate expression of Reformation study is to look at sociological economic concerns. But that's not exhaustive. There's a theological spiritual concern. And I might put it this way. The secularists emphasizes the socioeconomic interpretation of history at the expense of the theological. And the danger of the seminarian model is to emphasize a theological biblical study at the expense of the economic sociological. It's a both and, because God is sovereign over each. He's used both of them to bring them about. And so it's interesting that Luther understood this. In fact, in one of his writings, when he talked about the Turks invading the Eastern Front, you know what he called them? He said, the Turks or the Islamic hordes invading Europe are the masks of God. It's an amazing phrase. And the ugly mask that looks so terrifying, that somehow God was working even in that, because he understood that that struggle was actually helping the Reformation to take birth, that God was working through the difficult things in life. Maybe a good way to conclude it is this. Have you ever in your life been praying for something for years and years and say, Lord, why can't I just get this thing over? And then finally the blessing comes you've been waiting on and working for. You say, Lord, you could have done this 5 years ago. Why did it take till now? You ever ask God that question? Why? God loves history. God loves the process. We love the product. We love it when it's done. We love to say, shh, that's all done. We've gotten through it. This is what it's all about. You know, God loves the day-by-day struggle of his people. That's why there is history. If he didn't, it wouldn't happen. And so somehow God's delighted not just with the number of hairs on your head and the sparrows that fall in the field, but he's delighted to see the changing of boundaries and nations, of people rising and falling, kings coming and going, because it's in the matrix of all of these events that his glory is shown forth to the nations. In history, just like science, is studying the mind of God. And so I believe in providence. I believe we're seeing God's work, but we see it through the secondary agencies of human history, which is all within God's plan as well. I'll tell you what I'll do. If I can get together, I have a more full exposition of this. If I can type it up, I'll give it to you. All of these interpreters here would be largely 1800s and laters. We actually have historiography as a science actually comes into being after the Reformation. Eusebius is the first church historian about the year, about 300. And after that, there's very little real history writing. There's a little bit here and there. But after the Reformation, because of the need to interpret what went on and connect it with all that went before, historiography and Reformation studies comes into being. And so most of the kind of interpretation of a scholarly variety really is post-Reformational, even in church history as a whole. And these writers are largely, I would say, 1800s and 1900s.